This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Live and Learn with me, Dashran Johan. 37-year-old Hu Yu Wah, who's on death row in Bentong, received over 100,000 letters, emails and signatures from all over the world in support for his application for clemency and commutation for his death sentence. Now, this was announced by Amnesty International Malaysia at a vigil they organised to commemorate Yu Wah's recent birthday on the 5th of December and International Human Rights Day, which just took place on the 10th of December. So joining me on the show today is Brian Yap. He's a research consultant at Amnesty International Malaysia, and he's going to be sharing with us what happened to Yu Wah and why the death penalty should be abolished. Welcome to the show, Brian. How are you doing?
Thank you, Dashran. Thank you so much for having me. I'm doing well.
All right. Before we get into the whole discussion about the death penalty, perhaps you can start by telling us what exactly happened to Yu Wah in the first place. Take us back to 2005. How did he get arrested?
Sure. I'll go even a little bit before that. I just wanted to share a little bit about who Yu Wah is.
Right.
So he was born in sort of a working class family in Bentong, in Pahang. And he grew up in a Chinese new village, as the youngest of six siblings. So his parents were very much working class, economically, not exactly well off. He mentioned, he wrote in his memoir basically that he grew up, most of the grown-ups at that time have gone to town for work, and only elder people and really young children were left in the village. So there was not much things for him to do.
Right.
That was sort of his childhood. And in 2005, 31st March, he was arrested in a hotel in Johor Bahru. He was about to turn 21 at that time. Both he and his girlfriend at the time were arrested, and according to case documents, around 188.35 grams of methamphetamines were discovered in the room with them. And the two were then taken to a police station. And this is where there's differences in sort of what happened. The police claimed that Hu Yu Wah had opened a locked safe deposit box where the drugs were found, and they had taken the statement from him in the room. But in his defense, Yu Wah has said that it was only the next day he was made to sign a statement. And he also denied that he opened the safe deposit box, that it was actually unlocked at that time. So from Amnesty International's perspective, I think, the biggest big issue as far as from a human rights perspective is that, he was, Yu Wah has alleged that he was coerced into signing a statement, the statement.
Right.
And there was no legal representation at the time, which is a very common sort of scenario. I think many people who are, when they are initially arrested, they do not have a lawyer with them, and they are made to sign statements without legal representation. And Yu Wah has also alleged that the police used violence, had broken his finger, and threatened to beat his girlfriend if he did not sign the statement. And in court later, he would deny the accuracy of the statement. Right. As I mentioned, that Yu Wah basically grew up in sort of very poor kind of family, and so he dropped out of school at primary level. I think at age 11 or 12, he dropped out of school, and so he only speaks Cantonese and Mandarin and had not had a lot of, formal education. But the statement was recorded in Bahasa Malaysia, so that was one reason why he refused to sign it, because he wasn't sure what the contents of it was. And this sort of raises doubt about whether the statement should have been admissible under the Evidence Act, which does not allow sort of paraphrasing or even approximation of words used. So he gave a statement in Chinese, but it was recorded in Bahasa.
Right.
So all of this sort of raises doubt and also human rights concerns. Like I mentioned, the lack of legal representation, the allegations of torture. But unfortunately, I think the court did not here to take these issues into consideration. So ultimately, Yu Wah was convicted by the High Court of Johor Bahru in 2011, and was given the mandatory death penalty, which is the case for all drug offences in Malaysia. He filed an appeal, raising many of the concerns I just mentioned. But the Court of Appeal ultimately dismissed his appeal, and so did the federal court. And aside from, you know, the issues raised, there are also concerns about the quality of the legal representation. As I mentioned, his family is not exactly very wealthy. They spent all their savings and borrowed money for his defense. But even then, I think the lawyer they hired, you know, was not in court and assigned the case, assigned others to represent him instead. And when it came to the Court of Appeal, I think Yuhua had told his family, look, don't waste any more money on my case. I'll engage a government-appointed lawyer. And this government-appointed lawyer, you know, failed to communicate with them, the family, about the case. For instance, the family was not even aware that his appeal was dismissed until they visited him in Bentong Prison one day. So, you know, that's just a little bit of a background about how Yuhua ended up where he is today.
Right. And, you know, tell me about the vigil that took place to commemorate his birthday as well as International Human Rights Day. What was that all about?
So, Yuhua's case received overwhelming support from all over the world. So maybe I can just talk a little bit about how we ended up campaigning. So we thought that, you know, as I mentioned, there are lots of human rights issues with this case. And we thought it would make a good example of the many flaws of the death penalty as it's practiced in Malaysia. So we have a global campaign where we sort of share his story with people all over the world. And, you know, it was very touching to see the overwhelming support from all over the world. Like as you mentioned, over 100,000 people have, you know, some of them even wrote like handwritten letters, which is, you know, quite amazing in this day and age. And we wanted to highlight, I guess, to celebrate, not really celebrate might not be the best word, but like to commemorate how much support he has received, and also to highlight his case to the public, and also show support to the family. We decided to organize a small vigil outside of Bentong Prison where he is today. And, you know, partly to commemorate his birthday. He's 37 now. He's been in prison for like, you know, about 16, 17 years. And it was also Human Rights Day on 10th December. So it was a good opportunity to get more attention on the case among Malaysians. So that was why we did what we did. And we hope, you know, through this program and others like this, that more people would know about his story.
And what are y'all hoping to achieve next from this? Because, like you said, unfortunately, the Court of Appeal has dismissed and there, you know, he's already gone through various processes. What next for you and how are y'all approaching it?
Sure. So he has, despite the fact that after the federal court dismisses the appeal, there is still one avenue left for people on death row in Malaysia, which is the clemency application or the pardons application. There are many issues with this. I think we at Amnesty, through our research, we've covered this before, and it's a very opaque and sort of like non-transparent process. So Yuhua's family did submit an application, quite a number of years ago, I think in 2014. They submitted an application for his clemency. And, you know, it's one of those processes that, you know, without any sort of lawyer or any sort of advice, it can be a bit tricky to navigate. So they ended up submitting what is pretty much a very standard template letters appealing for his case, for him to receive clemency. But as I said, because the process is so opaque, they haven't heard back from this pardons board. In this case, it's the Johor Pardons Board. So, one, by highlighting this case and trying to get some public support around it, in addition to that, we are also working with the family to draft and write a new clemency application for Yuhua. And as well as we are also, as Amnesty International, we are also going to send our own letter, sort of highlighting our concerns about the case, and also showcasing, the overwhelming support that this Yuhua's case has received among people in Malaysia, as well as, you know, Indonesia, Singapore, the UK, the US, France, Australia, all over the world. So I think that's our role. We're trying to get public behind it, but also make sure the Pardons Board does its best to sort of hear his application and hopefully give it commute his sentence.
On the show with me today is Brian Yap, research consultant at Amnesty International Malaysia. After the break, I'll be asking him if the death penalty has proven to be a viable form of crime control. We'll be back with more on Live and Learn, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Live and Learn. I'm Dashran Johan, and on the show with me today is Brian Yap, research consultant at Amnesty International Malaysia, and we're discussing why the death penalty should be abolished. So, Brian, whenever there are reports of, let's say, drug mules being caught or put on death row, there are loads of people who either tend not to think much about it at all or just say, well, yeah, they are drug mules, they deserve it, who cares? But is it as plain and simple as that, Brian?
Sure, I think from our research, we put out a report on the death penalty in 2019. It's called Fatally Flawed, and people can go to our website to look at it. And what we found is, well, there's no conclusive evidence of this, but we looked at, you know, the type of professions that people on death row are from. And generally, most of them come from, they're unemployed or they come from sort of economically disadvantaged communities. You're not going to see a lot of white-collar people on death row in Malaysia. So this shows that there is a sort of disproportionate representation of poorer and economically disadvantaged communities in death row. And to us, that shows that, you know, this, the result of that is, I mean, the cause of that is, I think, primarily the fact that these communities don't receive enough support by the state. And maybe then there is an increased likelihood that they will resort to desperate acts or are vulnerable to being made to commit certain acts. I think people need to be understand that. And also the lack of resources also means you're less likely to have, as I mentioned earlier, quality legal representation. If you can hire a good lawyer, maybe chances are you would be able to, get access to a fair trial or even get acquitted or something. And, you know, there are good government-appointed lawyers. No offense to anyone who's a government-appointed lawyer, but even if they're good, sometimes often their capacities are often stretched, right? So I think this is what we mean when we say the death penalty disproportionately affects the poor. And furthermore, I think if you're talking about, you know, addressing the issue of like drug trafficking or drug addiction, the execution of drug mules does not really address the root causes of these problems, right? And, you know, there's a lot more, the bigger conversation to be had about how we address this. The death penalty, for the mandatory death penalty for drug trafficking was introduced, I believe, in 1983. And I think anyone who looks at the situation today will have to acknowledge that drug addiction and drug trafficking is not getting any better. In fact, it probably is worse than it was before. So obviously it's not effective.
So in a nutshell, do you think capital punishment should be abolished and why?
Well, I think while the many weaknesses of the system, as I've mentioned, is one reason why Amnesty is against death penalty, I think ultimately our position is that it's the ultimate sort of cruel, inhuman, and degrading punishment and must be abolished. You know, we don't really look at what the offense is, the method of execution, and so on. I think the fact of the matter is we think that the death penalty is something that is, you know, you do not solve violence or you do not solve crime by imposing more violence on society. And I think this is something that the world also shares. I think the world is increasingly moving away from the death penalty. 108 countries have completely abolished the death penalty by the end of 2020. And the execution, number of executions have also declined. From our statistics, 483 people were executed in 2020. This excludes China because we don't have data on China, which is down a significant 26% from 2019. So I think, and Malaysia itself is also, you know, sort of having, not say second thoughts, but like rethinking its policy on the death penalty, because since 2018, we have had a moratorium on executions. At the United Nations, we voted with many other countries to also support a global moratorium on executions. And I think, you know, a couple of years ago, we actually formed a task force. The government then formed a task force to look at alternatives to the death penalty. So there is an understanding that this is not tenable. Something needs to change in this situation. Unfortunately, I feel that the government has not been willing to sort of take the next step and really just say that, you know, let's abolish it. Or at least just start with abolishing the mandatory aspect of it, which, you know, at least judges should be given discretion to decide on, look at the specific circumstances of every case. Not to say like, oh, you violated this law, therefore you are, there's nothing I can do but sentence you to a hanging.
Now, how would you respond to people who say that, you know, you have these cases where certain maybe drug mules, they come from very poor families and poor backgrounds. Many of them get manipulated and so on and so forth. So, yeah, perhaps, you know, they shouldn't, get capital punishment. But, you know, the death penalty shouldn't be abolished because, you know, it strikes fear in people. And then this fear prevents people from committing crime. How do you respond to people who bring up this argument?
Well, I think there's very little evidence to show that the death penalty is an effective form of crime control. I think maybe it makes some people feel better. We're tough on drugs or tough on whatever, on crime. But ultimately, I think there's very little evidence to show that. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, like the mandatory death penalty was introduced in 1983. Drug trafficking, if you even ask the police, is actually worse than ever before, right? And many other factors contribute to the crime rate, including like poverty, inequality, and the capacity of governments to sort of enforce the rule of law. And I think there's also a misconception that, you know, supporting the abolition of the death penalty does not mean supporting sort of impunity for crime. We're not saying all criminals and that nobody is a criminal, everyone should be let go and nobody should be punished. We acknowledge that, you know, fully, definitely the suffering of victims of violent crime and their families, but we also recognize the duty of governments to protect people from becoming victims of crime. We believe that those found responsible in a fair judicial process should be punished. But simply what we're arguing is that just that the death penalty is not the solution to all of these problems.
If the death penalty is not the solution to these problems, especially when we zoom in on cases like UWAS, the laws don't seem to be effective. You're saying the death penalty isn't effective. There's little evidence to suggest that, the death penalty is a viable form of crime control. And so how then do we tackle the issue of low-level drug mules, drug traffickers? You know, they come from poor backgrounds. They're manipulated by giant syndicates, they get caught, they get thrown into prison, they get sentenced to death. But then the cycle just keeps continuing. So how do we change this? How do we stop this vicious cycle from just repeating itself over and over again?
Well, I think that's a very important question because it's complex, right? But I think, you know, recently we have seen a little bit of conversation about reforming drug laws in Malaysia. So I think that's a very welcome step. I think we've heard from ministers to, I think, even law enforcement and also like healthcare experts. They shared their views and hopefully that this will lead to some sort of reform because, you know, I think in many other countries, people are starting to look at drug addiction, drug abuse, and the problems that come with it as sort of a health issue. So you tackle it in a different way, and not just using the heavy sort of arm of the right law and punishing people. So it's a complex problem, and it's one that involves a lot of different factors. Just by punishing people and imposing a heavy sentence, that is not going to solve the problem. And I think that seems to be the case here. So I think in for us, I think it's important to look at the root causes of drug trafficking, drug abuse, drug addiction, and understand that it's the environment that people are in. It's poverty. It's all sorts of other issues that lead to these problems. And if you truly want to tackle them, hanging drug mules. And not, for example, not even going after like the drug kingpins, the people who are really profiting and benefiting from illegal drug trade. That is, what we should be targeting, and not people who just do make a mistake or do something out of desperation, and executing them, and then this brings pain and suffering to not just the individual, but to also to their families and the communities and people who love them, and while not really addressing the root causes of the issue.
So with that in mind, Brian, how would you respond to people who come to you and they ask you this? You know, they will say, you know, hey, Brian, the drugs are cancer to the society. It ruins the lives of so many people. So because of that, you know, it's good. You know, you should hang the drug traffickers. How do you respond to this argument?
Well, I think I would say, you know, I reiterate what I just said, you know, basically is that, which is that, you know, most of these people on death row are not drug kingpins. They're mostly all desperate people who wittingly or unwittingly were made to transport drugs. Hanging them, you know, sentencing to death does not solve the issue of the supply nor the demand of drugs. So maybe we should look at why there's a big demand for drugs. And why supply comes in and so easily, and then, you know, again addressing and I think there's small pockets of movements here and there about addressing drug addiction, for example, and the problems it causes as a health problem, you know, whether providing you know, sort of rehabilitation, providing some form of counseling and so on, and addressing the real reasons why people turn to drugs, right? You know, again, you know, the death penalty, mandatory death penalty, has been introduced in 1983, and I think many would agree that hanging, you know, we've hanged a lot of people since, and we sentenced a lot of people to death. But ultimately, the problem just remains the same, if not worse. Yeah.
So, what will it take for Malaysia to abolish the death penalty? How far along in the process are we? Because I do know that we are, you know, definitely more. We have moratoriums. We are more. We hold back on the death penalty compared to, let's say, Singapore. You know, where, you know, they are just proud of it, right? But yet we are far. We are still behind many, many progressive countries who have abolished it altogether. So, how far along of the process towards abolition are we, and what will it take for us to completely abolish the death penalty?
Well, I think it's good that we're at least having the conversation, both the public and also I think sometimes political leaders and also, you know, law enforcement and so on. I think there was a recent case of a woman who was sentenced to death in Sabah, and I think, you know, sometimes social media has its effect. I think it was captured on video and shared widely. This woman sort of breaking down, in a single mother, and probably resorted to sort of drug trafficking out of desperation. And people said, no, oh, why are we, you know, there are worse criminals out there. Why are we, you know, like inflicting so much on this woman who obviously, you know, is in a very desperate situation, right? So I think, you know, some movement there, but ultimately I think we need political will from and we saw that a little bit of that a couple of years ago. Unfortunately, it seems to have died down. The government at that time did in 2018 and 2019 did express its intention to reform some of these laws. So maybe we can do a first step. We're not, you know, maybe full abolition is not something immediately we can do, but let's start with maybe abolishing the mandatory aspect of it, right? And then maybe we can abolish it for some offences, and so on. So we need to, you know, look at see what steps we can do. And I think also, you know, I think you've mentioned, you know, you gave a lot of examples of how people can argue against the death penalty.
Right.
I think one important thing that the government can do is provide more transparent data on the effects of the death penalty. You know, publish full and detailed information about, you know, desegregated by gender, nationality, ethnic background, things like that. It's not easily available, but let's publish and share that so that people can have a more sort of educated or informed debate about the death penalty. Because I think whenever the death penalty is discussed, oftentimes people bring out the worst case scenario, like a gruesome murder, a sort of like a very violent crime. But the reality is, I think from our 2019 report, we found that about 70% of people are actually there for drug offenses, right? So they're not, you know, So maybe we can start with that. Maybe we can start by looking at, is it really this mandatory or even any sort of death penalty for drug offenses, which is something that international law and international human rights standards usually prohibits, because while, you know, we, Amnesty, are fully against any form of death penalty, the UN's position, I believe, is that, you know, it should not be imposed for non-violent and sort of crime that does not lead to directly to sort of death, right? And I think that's the case for 71% of people on death row in Malaysia, which is that they are there for some drug trafficking offences. So I think, you know, if we have a more transparent and clear sort of data that the government shares, then maybe people can have a more informed discussion about it. And as opposed to, I think sometimes it gets too emotional to the point where we only look at the very extreme cases and therefore shut down any sort of other debate about the issue. So maybe we can start with that.
All right. Brian, as we slowly wrap this conversation up, how can people join in the movement to you know, push for clemency for UR or just any other similar situations? How can people support and get involved?
Sure. I think, well, for UR's case, I think the campaign is still ongoing, so we're still receiving any sort of letters, signatures, and, you know, so go to our website, amnesty.my, or visit any of our social media platform, us on any social media platform, Instagram, Twitter, and so on. You'll very easily come across our information. Our handle is usually amnesty.my. So look for us and follow us on social media. And I think, you know, trying to have a little more conversations about this. If you're active on social media, post your thoughts, tweet about them. And also just like try to learn more, a little bit more about how the death penalty is practiced in Malaysia and why, you know, and hopefully you'll be able to understand that this is not justice. You know, I think is ending people's lives, keeping us safe, really, you know, start to ask these questions and make it a political agenda. Make it something that is, you know, something that you push your MPs or your elected representatives to have a state their position on and so forth. So I think, yeah, that's something, you know, that the public can do.
And there's something else the public can get involved that Amnesty is doing, and it's called Right for Rights. Am I correct? What is that exactly?
Sure. Thanks for giving me some time to talk about that. So basically, Right for Rights is a... it's our annual sort of global letter writing campaign. So it's not really limited to the death penalty per se, but I think it's also said to be one of the world's biggest human rights events. Basically, every year, Amnesty International globally selects 10 cases from around the world of human rights defenders or citizens, you know, facing human rights violations. And we then get our members, our supporters, and just generally members of the public to write letters of support to these human rights defenders, as well as letters to pressure their governments or whichever, you know, body is sort of inflicting, violating their human rights. And every year, this campaign generates powerful results. So in recent years, you know, we have had protesters being acquitted, people taken off death row, and journalists have been released from prison. So it has its effect. Similarly, you know, I think just to tie it back to UR's case, you know, it shows that these things are not just, you know, something we do to make ourselves feel good about ourselves, but they actually can have an impact and effect. So, you know, you can learn more about Right for Rights from our website. And basically, you know, we're running this campaign from now until early February. And then, you know, basically you can get you, your friends or whoever to basically to write these letters and sort of participate in this global sort of action to help human rights people from all over the world. And it's proven to work not only globally. I think in Malaysia, I think several years ago, we also campaigned for an individual named Shahrul Izzani.
Right.
Who was also on death row. And, you know, not to take full credit for it, but we did something similar to what we've done for UR. And ultimately, his sentence was commuted. So he sort of got out of the death penalty. So, you know, I hope that your listeners out there can realize that, you know, every little bit counts, and that nothing is impossible. I think we can all put our effort. If we all put our efforts and put our mind to it, sometimes we can do great things. So hopefully, in Yuwa's case, we hope that the Johor Pardons Board, realizing how much support Yuwa has, would also take a deeper look into his application and commute his sentence accordingly.
On that note, Brian, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
No, thank you so much, Dashan, for having me on this talk about this important topic.
I've been speaking with Brian Yap. He's a research consultant at Amnesty International Malaysia. If you missed any part of the conversation, you can check us out on podcasts. We are available on the BFM app, bfm.my, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. I'm Dashan Johan, and this has been Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.